Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. I know we have somebody who is here from some distance away, all the way from Ohio, right? So thank you very much for joining us. How did you find us? You said you looked up to saw exciting things to do in Phoenix. Well, and you weren't wrong. That's wonderful. And anyway, virtual audience, thank you very much for joining us. I'm delighted to be able to welcome Wendy Walker. Wow, that's alliterative. Back to the poison pen. I was not here for her last appearance. And Allison, you haven't been here before, have you? Or am I about to embarrass myself and you've been here too?
I'll lie and say I haven't. No, I have.
You have?
I have, yes. Just a couple of years ago, I think I came for If I Die Tonight, but...
Was I here?
You were not here. No, it was
Patrick. Good. That really makes me nervous because I thought, you know, I really think I do pay attention, but yeah, I probably wasn't. So this first time you two have been together here at the Pen. That part I have, right? And we are looking at Allison Galen is writing the Sunny Randall series, taking up the mantle of Robert B. Parker from Mike Lupica. And Mike has moved on to take up Ace Atkins' writing of Spencer. And I think he's still writing Jesse Stone, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Right. Yeah. And I have to say that Mike, for guys, I think he's almost more Parker than Parker.
Yes, I think
In fact, he has a bigger, I can say this because Bob is dead, so he can't be mad at me, but he actually has a better sense of humor, I think, in lots of respects. He's kind of puckish. And so his dialogue, I think, in the books is hard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I read both the Mike Lupica books and the Parker books. And I mean, Parker's dialogue is just, it's just perfection, mm-hmm. you know. And I think Mike Lupica followed in his footsteps beautifully. It's such a great job to have taking over because it's such an opportunity to, you know, find humor through dialogue. And Parker was just amazing at that, as is Mike Lupica.
Yeah, he really is. Now, we'll come back to this, talking about how Allison has brought Sunny Randall into the digital age. I don't think this was the plot that Bob could have written. So that part's really fun. But Wendy is here to talk about What Remains, which is her first thriller for a new publisher. Yeah, how's that experience going?
You know, it's been really wonderful. They have given me a lot of freedom to take everything that I learned writing my five previous thrillers and to sort of pull them together and take the tools I learned writing the first two, which were deeply psychological and more of a slow burn. And then the second two were a little bit faster paced. And to pull those together and combine them in this book, I could really see those tools coming together. And they gave me the freedom to do that, which was really wonderful. So it was a really great experience. And I just finished another book for them, which will be out next year. And I had the same experience writing that. So it's been great.
That is great. And I might be wrong, but I have a recollection because they have come to see us, this new publisher called Blackstone. Some of you might know them from audios that they do. They're huge in audiobooks, but they have a different editorial process, if I remember this right, than more conventional publishers, and they have what they call developmental editors. They have an acquisition editor team, but then they have the same way that Amazon Publishing works too. They have people who actually, first of all, somebody has to acquire the book, okay? They have to like the book and decide to buy it so it'll get published. And then oftentimes that book is either already written and just needs some editorial assistance, or sometimes it's even ready to go. But I do think that this deeper approach, it might be annoying to some authors, but I mean, I'm not saying everybody would like that, but I think it's very helpful in lots of respects.
I think, you know, if you were a new author coming into it, you might not know any differently from how they do it. But yes, so the first book was written and it was acquired, and we did actually a major structural revision with the acquiring editor. And then it does go out to an outside editor And that can change. It's sort of a freelance editor. And it's really wonderful because that's another person getting eyes on the book. And they sort of know the process it's already been through. So they're not going into it cold. So they know, okay, we like the structure, we like the characters, but we just want you to see where it can be fine-tuned. And it's really great to have that because there are so many readers that are hopefully going to read your book, and you want to appeal to as many of them as you can. And so your acquiring editor might love the amount of backstory you've given a character. They might love the, you know, the ending, or the darkness in it. But then the outside editor may say, you know what? I think it could use a little more pacing, a little less backstory here, a little more there. And then it just allows you to get that extra read. And then with a book that was not written, I just pitched some ideas, wrote 100 pages, and my acquiring editor loved it. And I wrote the whole book. And it was really a wonderful process, I have to say. Like, having that extra person to get those eyes on the book was great.
I'm getting them. What is your process and how do you write questions out of the way first tonight before we get to the stories? So let me turn to Allison and say, you know, what is it like to step into somebody else's universe? Because you obviously have written books of your own, but you are now writing in somebody else's world with somebody else's characters. What kind of an adjustment, if any, did you have to make?
Oh, it's a big adjustment and somewhat intimidating. I'm, you know, stepping into this world of Robert B. Parker, which is, he has such, it's, I really liken it to being given an amazing toolbox and said, you know, build this table with it. Like, I just already have this great toolbox. It's such a wonderful bunch of characters. His dialogue is so great. I have the license to use more humor than I normally do in my standalone books. It was somewhat intimidating. It was less intimidating than, say, if I were going to be taking over Spencer or Jesse Stone, because I'm the first woman to be writing this female character that was written by two men previously. So I felt like I had a little bit of a leg up as far as, you know, personal experience. I found the process so much more fun than I maybe at the beginning, when I was intimidated and scared, actually diving into the book and just seeing, you know, how much I had to work with in terms of Sunny's friends and her family and, you know, people she knew in the mob and on the police force. It was very easy to sort of create a story with these characters.
How about Boston? I mean, you can't do Parker if you're not doing Boston, because all of his books are set, well, sorry, two of them are Boston, one of them is right nearby.
Yeah, I love Boston, and my father was from Boston. Oh. And I've been there a lot, and it was a great excuse to take a trip to Boston and get friends of ours to take us around and take us to all these great restaurants. I did a post about this recently. The Parker books are so great to research because he only puts real bars and real restaurants in his books. So when you're going to write one of these books, you have to go to all these Boston bars and restaurants.
I have sad news, though, that two of the restaurants that he most often went to in Spencer are not there anymore. Because when I went to Boston, I actually made a pilgrimage and discovered that his favorite bar was no longer. And then, what was it, Lockover? It's closed. And so you're nodding your head, sir. So you had that same, shattering moment when you thought, I'm going to go and do Boston, Spencer's Boston, and eat Spencer Boston. And, you know, but, you know, Bob published his first book in either 73 or 75. I'm so old that I've read him in real time. I mean, I remember when the Godwolf manuscript published and how exciting it was to have this new voice. And Bob actually got into crime with his PhD dissertation, and he remained a professor for a while, I think,
yes,
while he wrote Because not everybody, you know, can sustain a life on what you're paid for your first novel. Actually, probably almost nobody can do that. And so it was handy. Well, yay. But it was handy. But, you know, the really interesting thing, there's a whole, there are a great many what we call legacy publishing things going on. And a lot of that is a response to you readers, because, you know, when the author dies, that's sad. You know, we're sorry to lose Bob, but many people are sorrier if they're going to lose Spencer or, you know, Jesse or Sonny. I've had many customers over the years when news comes that an author has died and they go, oh no, you know, because the character is going to go into the grave as well. So authors have to decide, legally decide, whether or not anyone can continue. I mean, there's a whole literary estate thing that authors need to draft up. I have nagged many of them to do it, because if you don't, word to the wise here, if you don't, anybody can actually take over your books and so forth. But so you need a literary executor and a plan. And most of the time, the money will go to the family. For example, Bob's two children. The Sherlock Holmes estate was in turmoil for ages over the copyright and who owned it, because it went to, I think it was a hospital, a charity anyway, in the UK, who didn't want to let go of it. So copyright issues and, you know, all kinds of tension. You know, any of you know Laurie King's Mary Russell series? She couldn't publish it in the UK for a long time because of the copyright issues. So anyway, probably more than you wanted to know, but it's an interesting question. What I thought I might start with, I know you two have read each other's books. Yay, because I never assume that when two authors are here, they have read each other's books. So I'm going to get out of the way. But when Megan Abbott was here a week ago Sunday, there were two questions that came up that I think actually apply to both of your books. One of them was, do you really know the person you married? Or at least, you know, your partner, whatever. And the other is, what does a child owe his parents, his or her parents? And particularly if there is a partner or a spouse also involved. And that really works for both of your books, doesn't it? I think. Right. So Megan had one set of answers in a really scary book called Beware the Woman. So there's a whole thing going on called neo-Gothic, but basically it's kind of Rebecca set on the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. Yeah. I know it is. But anyway, I think those questions are really great. So would you like to just talk to each other about it, and I'll slide over there?
Oh, sure. Okay.
Right. Why don't you move over here, Allison? It won't look so silly.
So Allison also writes standalone thrillers, and we were speaking earlier. We met. This is the first time we've met.
Yes.
So we actually caught each other up on our careers and all of the things that we've written, and we were talking about writing dark psychological thrillers, which is what she writes outside of the Robert Parker series. And this issue of childhood and mothers, daughters, parents, and children, it really goes to trauma. And I think trauma is at the heart of psychological thrillers, right? It's the things that happen to us throughout our lives, often in childhood, but also at other points in time. Which is what happens in What Remains. This is the first book I've written that doesn't actually involve childhood trauma and people who are sort of coming into the story already emotionally compromised by trauma. This is the story about a woman, a detective, who stumbles into a violent crime occurring, and she takes one life to save another. And that is a trauma that ignites the rest of the story. But that's really, I think, what you were speaking with Megan, is that thrillers, I think that's what really is at the base of all of them, because that's where the psychological dysfunction comes from and the sort of dark stories. I think that's they emerge from trauma.
Yeah, I mean, in your book, in What Remains, there are two distinct instances where she goes through trauma that we see on the page, and then there's the aftermath of both of it. And I actually was going to ask you about that, because there's, she's traumatized throughout the entire book. The main character, whose name is Elise, is, she spends the entire book in trauma. How do you effectively write trauma on the page without making it, you know, just sort of agonizing for a reader, because it is really compelling the way you, yeah, you write it.
Oh, thank you. And it's, well, I, and you know, when you're writing a story that requires a fast paced plot, but also enough backstory and psychology so the reader understands why the characters are doing what they're doing, it's a balancing act. And that's why you need a lot of eyes on the book to say, too much backstory, too much psychology, not enough. Why is she doing that? Okay, I'll add more. It's a balancing act. So in What Remains, what happens after this incident, she, the man whose life she saved becomes obsessed with her because he is also traumatized with what is called rescue worship. And I won't go into the lengthy explanation for it, but it is something that can happen to people when they are in a sudden violent situation and are rescued. And it's a way for them to process that trauma and to be able to carry on with their lives by understanding the trauma in a context. So they understand it in terms of feeling destined to be with their rescuer. And that's how they rationalize it and can say, okay, this won't happen again. It was just this one time because the universe meant for me to meet this person. So this man becomes obsessed with her and torments her throughout the book. But yes, it's a balancing act because I needed to both move the plot forward but explain why he's doing it. And also she makes a lot of bad decisions about how to handle this. She feels very alone and her trauma has made her feel alienated from the people she loves because they're like, just get on with it. You're a hero. Everyone thinks you saved the day, but that's not how she feels inside. So having to explain that as well is hard, right? I mean, I'm sure that you've had a similar, sort of decision-making in chapter by chapter. And my gosh, when I was reading this book, I was thinking, how do you write, how do you pick up for someone who's just new to this, like me? You were able to give me an idea of the characters' relationships with each other that is, what, 10, 11 books in, but without it being sort of bogging down the plot.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I mean, it does kind of come back to how well do you really know your husband or your ex or your family or your parents? I don't know, Sunny has a unique relationship with all of these people, with her ex-husband in particular. That's what fascinated me the most about the Parker books, is this great love she feels for her ex-husband, which is not something you see very often. And it's like she can't live with him, can't live without him. Yeah. And I was very drawn to that, so I decided to make that a big part of the book. And I do think, like in Megan's book, Megan has a line in that book that we all marry strangers. You know, that's what her mother, that's what the character's mother says to her. And that's so astute. I think we do, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, I've been married for 29 years now. And, you know, I know my husband pretty well, but I'll never know him completely. We'll never know anybody completely. And that's actually interesting in your book because I don't, gosh, how much do I say without giving spoilers? Can I say that?
Yeah,
okay, so the husband, you know, he had an affair a few years ago, and it's part of this woman's trauma that she's going through. She's dealt with a lot, Elise, yeah. You know, before the shooting. She's been through a lot. Yeah. So, you know, and it's interesting because when we were talking about it, you were saying that you'd gotten some negative response about the husband because yeah. People don't want to see a cheater in right. A book, but you really did a good job of making him just a, you know, he's a fully developed human being despite right. His flaws. So actually, what made you decide to have that happen? Like, why? Yeah. Why?
Why?
So,
why did I do that to her? Because it's my job. It's just, right? I feel like it's our job to torture our characters. We have to torment them and torture them and give them so much stuff to deal with. No, I actually, this was interesting because I'm a plotter and I want to find out if you're a plotter or a pantser. You know the expression being a pantser when you fly by the seat of your pants. So in the writing community, it's like, I feel like there are two camps. And there's the plotting camp and the pantser camp. So I want to know which one you're in. I'm a plotter, so I usually know these things. But I was writing just a scene between Elise and her husband, Mitch. And, you know, it was getting to that point of they no longer know each other because what has happened from this shooting has changed her. And he doesn't understand why. And so she withdraws from him. And whatever they knew about each other is suddenly sort of off. So now they know even less about her because she's changed. She has changed further. Whatever it was before, it's even worse now. He really doesn't know her and she feels alone. So I'm writing this scene and I just started writing some dialogue and internal thoughts about his affair 4 years ago. And I thought, oh, what am I doing? I'm writing a whole plot line into this book that I didn't already like think was going to happen. And so I just kept writing it. And then I ended up going through the rest of my plot and weaving it the thread through. And I came up with a whole other little scenario that's woven in to the book. But so I want to know if you're a plotter or a pantser. And I also want to know how you, when writing her, she's a woman who's how old is she? Do we know?
Sunny's probably 39. That's what I thought.
Forever. Right.
Yes.
39 forever.
She was 34. What I said was she was 34 when the book came out in 1999. Yeah. And she's aged about 5 years in the last 23 years.
Right. And so, she's right. Exactly.
Be a character in a book.
Right.
She's unconventional
and that she's divorced. Right. So yeah. her attitude towards men is really, you know, it's sort of, you know, edgy.
Yeah.
And so when you're writing that, taking on this legacy as a woman, when it was previously written by men, what are the spicy things that you added in being a woman writing a woman?
You know, I feel like Sunny is, in some ways, I don't think she's quite as feminine in the way that I write her as the way men wrote her. Both Parker and Lupica did have her a little like somewhat competitive with other women about their looks, you know, and things like that. To me, I don't know. I haven't felt that way with other women since I was 12. Like I don't look, you know, I'd be like, oh, she's so pretty, I hate her. I have not had that thought in my mind since I was 12 years old. Like I've thought, I wish I had that. I wish I had her wardrobe. You know, I wish I had her money. I wish I had, you know, that who does her hair. I'll think that. Right. But I won't be like, she's so pretty, I hate her. So that was one, like, it was just a little tweak, like a minor change, you know, in terms of writing it, you know, from a female point of view. But I do like Sunny's sort of liberated attitude towards relationships. Like, she's never needed to define herself through a man. She has been married. She loves men. But she's, her job really kind of comes first with her. And I love that about her. And she's good at her job and she's smart. She's tough. You know, she can shoot a gun. She can figure out a crime. She's a smart, cool woman. I really like her. And she's got a really loyal bunch of friends, which shows what a likable character she is. Yeah. She's got a friend like Spike, who's the best friend that everybody wants on the planet. I think he's one of my favorite characters ever committed to literature. And I get to write him now. I'm so excited. It's interesting. It's interesting to sort of, you know, step into that world and
likable characters. When you're writing psychological thrillers, it's not a luxury we usually have.
I don't think,
right?
I've ever written a likable character until now. Yay!
Yeah, we were talking earlier about writing, about authors now really branching out and having the freedom. I don't know what's brought that on. I recently wrote an article for Crime Reads about this, my own like hypothesis about it, which was had to do with COVID and people just, you know, sort of a lot of rules were broken during COVID. But we see thriller writers writing romance, and we see, you know, just fiction writers going into thrillers, and there's some fluidity now. And I think it's so interesting to be able to write these likable characters where the plot, where the characters are really well established and the plot is circling around them. Mm-hmm. And they're going to go through that plot and they're going to go to another plot and another plot, which is so different from a standalone psychological thriller where the plot is about what these characters are going through. And people often ask me, oh, is this going to be a series? And with every book, I think, gosh, what else can I do to these poor characters? I mean, it's hard to think about doing that, but this gives you the freedom to keep these characters likable and steady while having a plot circle around them. So how do you put on both hats in like the same year or year and a half and write both books? Like, how do you switch between the two?
I think they kind of inform each other. I think they're both, it's like a great sort of, they're both kind of a palate cleanser for each other. Because it's like, I just finished a standalone and very, very, very dark and, you know, just kind of horrifying. And you know, and I wrote that book, you know, the end of last year, and then I'm going to be writing another Parker book, which I'm very excited about. So it's like they sort of inform each other in a way, you know. It's like I used to write for magazines, you know, when I say I was a journalist, I use the term very loosely because I was I wrote for trashy entertainment magazines. And it was another form of fiction, you know. So I was writing about the Kardashians a lot, and I was doing that. And so that was, you know, in a way, that was a palate cleanser for my dark, you know, horrifying things that I write. Not that my books are that horrifying, but you know, they're on the dark.
Now side. I need to know what this book is about. The horrifying book. I perked up. I'm like, a horrifying dark book.
Well, the next one, yeah. Well, it's like so. But yeah, so you know, I think it's more gratifying than any sort of day job would be to write the Parker books. I feel like I'm carrying all on. I take it very seriously because I feel like I'm carrying on the legacy of a master, an absolute master, and I feel so honored that I was chosen to do that, and it's so meaningful to me. But it's also so much fun, yeah. You know? So there's that. So I have this great job, and then I can write my own dark stuff.
So we were on the walk over here from the hotel. We were talking about writing dark thrillers and then lighter
yes.
books.
Yes.
And it's every time I meet another thriller writer, they're so lovely and so full of joy. And people ask, well, how can you write such dark things? And I was asked this recently, and I really thought about it. And I think there's something, and you said a palate cleanser, and that made me think about this question, that there's something about going into the darkness of humanity and emotional turmoil and the things that people go through that then allows the light to be brighter. It's like if you shine a flashlight in a bright room, you don't see it. If you shine it in a dark room, it's bright.
Yes.
And I feel like that is when I'm writing a dark thriller, when I come out of it, I feel this like greater joy for the good things and for the normal things. And yeah, it's so interesting, right? I don't know. Do you feel similarly when you're switching between the two or?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely. I mean, you were discussing that you've done Audible originals,
yes.
which are
lighter. They're lighter. Yeah. They're, it's a place for me to write lighter suspense. Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. I think having that variety. And now I'm working on a short story now too, and I love writing short stories. Short stories, I think I go darker than anything, right? Because
really?
you can hate your characters in a short story. You only have to spend 5,000 words with them. So just friggin' just kill them. Just do everything you want with them. And it's so much fun. It's like the yeah. opposite of, you know, wanting to preserve these characters,
right.
Like just this, you could just go so dark and so cynical, and it's really, really fun, I think. Ooh. Do you like to write short stories? Do you do that
I've
at all?
Never written a short
really?
Story, but now I want to.
Oh, I
now
it.
I want to write
that's
dark,
the,
dark,
that's
dark.
That's a palate cleanser. That's like the best, because then you feel like you're writing, you know.
Right. They are hurt. I'm going to circle back because now I have a couple of questions
okay.
for you. Yep. Here I come. Nope. You stay right there. So I'm gonna ask Wendy first, because this also came up last night in that we talked about a really terrific police procedural, and much of what the character goes through is he's suffering from imposter syndrome, which is really what your character, at least to some degree, is doing, which is, you know, what happens if you get credit or something happens and you feel that the story that results from it makes you an imposter. And that's a lot of what Elise is going through in your book, is that she, you know, doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So she, when I was researching trauma, one of the most fascinating things that I discovered, which I then wrote into the book and into Elise's story, is that, and actually just backing up a little bit, the book was inspired by listening to news accounts of the shooting in Boulder, Colorado a few years ago. And I was driving around doing errands when it came on the news. It had just happened. And it was a strange situation because the reporters got there before they had information from the first responders. So they were getting firsthand accounts from the people, the bystanders who were rushing out of the store. And I had never experienced that before, you know, hearing that their stories, their voices, they were traumatized, and then they disappeared from the story. We didn't hear from them again because they weren't injured. Not, you know, they were fine. We heard from the families of the victims. We heard from, you know, about the shooter. We heard from the first responders. And so that's what sparked interest in this concept. What happens? What remains of a person after they've experienced that kind of emotional trauma, but no physical harm? And so this imposter syndrome is very, very similar, because you are changed, but no one can see it because you're not physically injured, and everyone just expects you.
Well, yeah, it's partly that, but it's also you're getting credit for something you didn't actually do. And then you feel, you know, that you're invalid. I mean,
yeah.
and that's what happens to this cop who doesn't remember the moment when he shoots not in your book, but in the one that was last night. But then the police department crafts a hero story around him because they need a hero story. And he can't accept that role. And then his colleagues pick up on that and start treating him bad. This happens in military fiction. That's something that can come up where somebody, you know, is credited for some brave act in combat or something, and he gets a medal and all, and then, you know, and doesn't feel as though he deserved it or earned it. And this can be really damaging to a person, because your whole identity then becomes in question, and how you relate to people. If they see you as one way, but you don't believe that you're that person, what happens to you?
Right,
and that turns out to be the motivation for the character in Wendy's book, because she's so intent on finding this guy who turns out to be a horrible, you know, stalker. Right. But he's the witness that can.
There's more than one imposter in the book.
Yeah, exactly.
It kind of rises up. So, Allison, as I told you before, my history with Bob Barker goes back forever. He was here many times. We did his actual last live event, if I remember right, and which we had to hook him off stage, because it was just a few months before the Mystery Writers of America finally gave him an award and made him their grandmaster. And he was so excited about it. And he was here in March, and the ceremony's at the end of May. And Bob didn't really love doing talky book events. He was not happy doing that, but he liked it here. So we started at 7, and at 8:45, I said to him, the store's full of people. I said to Bob, we really ought to, you know, I'm getting a hook. We really need to stop. And he smiled at everybody, and he said, but you could all call me Grandmaster Bob. And so the next day I told his publisher, your publisher, they wrote back and said, now you had some other Robert B. Parker that night. It really wasn't Bob. But here was the thing with Bob that is central to all of his stories, and it stems from his own relationship with his wife, is that it's a can't live with you, can't live without you situation. And he, I wouldn't talk about this if he were still with us, but since he's not, I can. He and Joan had that kind of relationship. And if you read the Spencers, there's a trilogy in the Spencers where he and Joan actually had separated. And it's not clear whether Spencer and Susan, who's his main interest, are going to get back together. I mean, it was a real trauma. Bob and Joan ended up living in different floors of their house, is what happened, which I've been to and, you know, spent time there the whole bit. So that comes over into the book. So all three of his characters, Sonny and Richie, Jesse Stone, and I can't even remember what her name was, where we started out, and Spencer and Susan. And eventually, after the Spencer-Susan split, Bob decided to give them a relationship where they were going to be only faithful to each other. But he kept the rest of it for Jesse, and he definitely kept it for Sonny. So I think as an author, at some point, you don't have to do that. You're going to need to decide at some point whether Sonny is really going to stay in that limbo. Bob got over it. Spencer and Susan actually got over it. Jesse still in the wilderness, right? But I don't know that Sonny really has to constantly, you know, be on the split.
I like her and Richie together.
Well, I always did too. I used to nag at Bob. What's wrong with you? Why can't we have Susan and Richie together?
And Michael Buckeye had just broken up her and Jesse Stone right before I started.
That's right.
The book, and I'm like,
he started down that path, and he and I had a discussion about that. Right. I didn't think that that was a very good idea at all.
I mean, it was funny because when I tried out for the book, he was still with Jesse, so I put Jesse in there. But yes, I mean, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be this endless thing of can't live with you, can't live without you.
I think if you string it out too long, it gets tiresome for everybody. And since Bob himself actually finally completed that circle with Spencer and Susan, I don't think there's, this is me telling her how to write her book, right?
So
sorry about that.
Advice.
But you know, I don't know that you will talk to that many people who really do Bob and his work like I do. And I found myself right before, you know, in the last year or so of Bob's life, saying to him, you know, why are we doing this with Sonny and Richie? I mean, Richie's father is a crime boss. Sonny, you know, comes down on the side of the law, and she's a private investigator. Richie's father is a mob figure in Boston. And that was sort of the ostensible reason why Sonny had a hard time with Richie. It wasn't so much Richie, but the baggage and the family. Coming back to that other question that I posed, you know, what does a parent owe a child?
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, but she does love Richie's father, you know.
Bob was very good at making the mob guys many-sided, many-faceted, and often ended up helping. You're a Parker fan, right? So, okay, so am I off track here? Right. So he, you know, there are a whole bunch of them. Then often Spencer and Jesse would have to, more not so much Jesse, because he's a policeman, not a private investigator. Jesse has to walk the line a little more in terms of real rules than but Sonny and Spencer don't have to do that. So sometimes those guys come in and help. And in this book, in fact, there's two of them that get involved.
Yes, exactly.
There's a lot of duality in what Bob writes.
There are. I found this that not only does Sonny's former father-in-law, you know, come into play in this book, but there's also a mobster called Moon Monahan that was in one of Parker's books. It was Blue Screen.
I've lost the titles pretty much.
He's not sweet like
like her father. He's just a nasty mobster, Moon Monahan. But it was fun to, it's fun to like kind of reach back and take some of these characters and put them in the present, you know. So,
well, I'll be interested to see what you do with it. The other thing that's interesting in this book, I referred to it earlier, Bob could never have written this book, is because the key to it are a pair of Instagram stars. A man and a woman, and they are, you know, they've crafted a completely fictional life, which is largely what influencers do, right? Except for book influencers, we stay real.
Yes.
But, right. And, you know, I'm not sure that Bob would really have adjusted to the whole, you know, TikTok, Instagram world. But I think I like the fact that you've made it current. So we all have to accept the idea that people don't age in real time in these books. I mean, Sunny couldn't, for one thing, she couldn't endure the personal, you know, the athleticism and all the rest of it. Is she speaking as a real senior? You can't do that kind of stuff when you get older. So, you know,
if you age 5 years and 23 years, then you can do it.
But if you make her much older, she won't really be credible.
Right.
I mean, Spencer, if you think, Spencer was a Korean War hero when it started. And by the end of the time Bob was writing it, I think he'd moved up through Vietnam to maybe the Gulf War.
Right.
But, you know, by now, Ace's version of it, he was in the sandbox, yeah. You know. So you just, as readers, do you care? Do you care? I mean, don't you want your characters to go on being largely who they were? I mean, think of what's happened to Harry Bosch, for example, in the Michael Connelly series. You know, they aged him in real time, and now he isn't even a cop anymore because he's too old. He had to retire. So, Rebus, for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a choice. But I think, anyway, speaking for me as a reader, I'm perfectly happy to have Sunny remain 39 forever.
Me too. Mm. I'd like to be 39.
All right.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to be 39 again. I know.
It makes sense, you know, in terms of her job, like you said, and her athleticism, and also in terms of her personal life, right, to a degree, because she would be in her late 50s, you know, probably at this point, and it's like that just, you know, that's tiresome after a while, like, oh, am I going to be with Jesse or you know, Richie?
Just encouraging you to have some freedom here, but yeah, you know, you don't have definitely to follow the total Parker template.
Well, it was interesting. It's interesting about the, you know, the Instagram influencers, because I got this job because my agent told me that, you know, Mike Lupica was taking over for Ace, you know, to write the Spencer series, and I had a chance to try out to write the Sunny book. So I just started, they said, just write us 20 pages of anything with Sunny. So I did. And this idea of Instagram influencers just popped into my mind, because I'm thinking she's 39 years old. You know, she's been through the whole pandemic, but she hasn't even been online during that time. Like, what? Why? You know, why? Why is this woman so adverse to any form of social media? Because she really is. If you read the book, she's not on there. She texts every once in a while, but she doesn't. So I thought it would be really fun to see her reaction to people like this whole lifestyle where you are not like bookstagrammers, but where you are aspirational versus like you're allegedly allowing people into your home and all the products you use in your personal life and your, you know, in your body and everything, but it's all filtered and airbrushed and perfected, and the goal is not to be real but to be aspirational. So how would she feel about that? So I thought that would be an interesting world for her to see.
Not only that, there's a lot of money in it. And, you know, one of the streams in crime fiction is there should be a money trail.
Yes.
So, you know, it makes a big difference.
I also introduced Sunny to OnlyFans. I don't think she ever didn't know about OnlyFans before this book either. But, you know, she did.
Yeah. She's making progress. Patrick.
Oh, well, some of them were rebelling. Can you ask Allison to speak into the mic?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. Okay.
There are a bunch of questions, but are we there yet?
Yeah.
No, I really wanted to talk to Allison about Sunny and this whole, you know, can't live without.
I think that's such a great idea. And I actually, I feel like because you were close
to Bob Parker, I feel like I have the freedom to.
We used to drink at the Biltmore and discuss stuff like this. He would stay at the Biltmore and I would go out and he drank. I have no head for alcohol. One glass of wine is kind of like it. So I would have to nurse my way through, you know, whatever it was. But Patrick was here for many of Bob's visits, and you know, he was an amazing guy. And then we emailed a lot. And actually, I'll finish my favorite moment with Bob in many respects. He was a Red Sox fan, and I grew up in Chicago, so the Chicago Cubs. So when we got together, we would say, well, either of us live long enough for one team. So when the Red Sox had that first, you know, miraculous, you know, pennant chasing thing, Bob and I would write back and forth after every game, you know, closer, you know, and then of course there's that whole thing about a no hitter and, you know, you can't mention it or you'll ruin it, but still we kept on. And finally on the very last game of the series, I think it went to 7 games if I remember right, and the Red Sox won. I looked at my husband, I padded down the hall to my office and I opened up my keyboard and I wrote to Bob Yay, Bob, I said, how does it feel? And Bob Parker, master of dialogue, and the whole of it, his answer was, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Seriously, that was the answer. You know? But anyway, I was so happy that he did live long enough. And then I did, too, because the Cubs finally won. So, you know, it was great.
That's fantastic.
I know.
That's so great.
But, yeah, but, you know, I'm not sure that Bob would have continued the Sonny Richie after he brought Susan and Spencer together. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that he would have. We don't know what he would have done, but that for that reason, I don't think you're hamstrung.
You know what? I think you're right, and I also feel like you can write about a marriage and make it rich and complicated and have conflict within it. You know, the conflict doesn't have to be will they or won't they get together. There can be deeper conflicts or more interesting.
And none of this really applies to you writing standalone. So I'm sorry.
No,
but you did ask the question about
series. And I was just thinking how interesting it is. The broader question of how much writers bring their personal lives and their personal experiences into a book. Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning, you know, Bob's marriage and how that may have influenced how he made all of these relationships play out. And now there's like a whole new sheriff in town who's bringing, you know, a different perspective and different life experience, because I think we all, right, we all bring our life experiences into our work, and especially in these relationships. So it's really interesting to have an avid fan who's read all of the books and a new writer to the books, so having this conversation about where these characters could go now that, you know, it's sort of under your umbrella of life experience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's wonderful. The other thing I really loved about Bob, he was a great, big, burly, athletic guy. I have a fabulous photo that Richard Chismar sent me. He and Bob were in school together. Of Bob, they were running track, and, you know, he's in his shirt and his shorts, and, you know, he was a big, athletic guy. He and Joan had 2 sons, and both of them are gay. And Bob, to his credit, at a time when you would not imagine a child of, you know, I guess he might be my age anyway, was so proud of those boys, so loved those boys. That's why, is it, which book is it? Looking for Rachel Wallace, and then there was another one. You know, and so Spike, who is a character that Allison has mentioned, who is one of Sonny's great friends, is in fact gay and runs a restaurant bar in Boston that's very welcoming to that. So Bob, you know, Bob really, in many ways, you know, was remarkably ahead of his era.
He really was. He had he had so much diversity on the, you know, across the canvas in terms of sexual orientation, really.
I'm not sure that Bob could write Hawk today, because there's a real pressure on authors, you know, to be authentic, you know, the authentic voice thing. But Hawk, I think some of the best dialogue he ever wrote was Spencer and Hawk together. Yeah, oh, my God. Awesome. It was just fabulous. You know, I don't, as I said, I'm not sure he could do that today, but fortunately it's been established in the same way that I don't think Tony Hillerman could publish the Joe Leaphorn series today at the very beginning, not being a Navajo. It would be hard. Patrick, come back, because you said you had questions.
Yes, Spike is just a great character, though, yeah, because he's a gay man, and but he's not like this stereotypical gay BFF character. He is like the most badass, tough character. He reminds me of, there's a gay character in the movie Papillon, and I love that character, and I've always wanted to write that character into something, and that's the closest I've gotten, is being able to write Spike. But that was what thrilled me, be able to write him.
Okay, you're right. I think you actually answered most of their questions.
Oh,
okay. But one of them, and Barbara, can you repeat it for them?
Sure.
I don't have the mic.
Oh, here, I'll give it to you.
It's easy, right? Hey, that way.
All right. So one of the questions is, does Sunny still paint and go for runs?
Yes, she does paint. I haven't had her running yet, but she might in the next book. But she does still paint. She mentions her painting in this book, yes.
And more of a general question. How did you both get into the suspense mystery genre to begin with? And who were some of your influences and inspirations?
So I was actually writing more general fiction many, many years ago. They call it women's fiction, but I don't call it women's fiction because it's just fiction about women. And sorry, they don't call fiction about men dude fiction. So I don't call it women's fiction. So bro fiction, yeah. No, so I was writing general fiction about mostly women characters. And I actually, my agent actually suggested that I try writing a dark psychological thriller after Gone Girl and Girl on a Train sort of opened up this field for suspense to have unlikable characters and unreliable narrators. And I didn't even know what that was. I had always read Grisham and legal thrillers. And so when I sort of did a sort of research into what it was about these books, I was like discovering candy as a child. I was like, wait, what? I can do that? I didn't know I could do that. And it was just so that, and I wrote All Is Not Forgotten in, you know, like, I don't know, 6-7 weeks or something. That was on a tear. I was so like liberated to write this really dark, unreliable narrator, unlikable character. So yeah. And so I would have to say like Gillian Flynn, I know that's sort of cliche to say that, but I feel like she really went there before anybody else did in terms of, you know, just letting it fly with, and even with her previous books. So she's a huge inspiration.
Do you think, do you think writers are sometimes shackled by this? They think they have to be write characters that are like themselves, you know, and.
You know, people do, like when they meet you, like Wendy was saying, they say, wow, you're nice. I didn't expect
you're not
to be
this,
nice. And I thought, no, you know, maybe not, but. but it's interesting. I think especially with women writers, there was a lot of pressure to write likable characters. I published my first book in 2005, and back then it was sort of like, if you're a woman writer, are you writing romantic suspense or are you writing cozies? Or there was very little leeway in there for, and I wasn't really doing either. And I think they put me more into romantic suspense, and I had like no romance in my books, and you know, people hated them. So, but not enough. But there was this pressure to write likable characters, and it was a real insult to a woman to, your character's not likable. And it's almost as though if you have a female main character, this was back then, that you were representing all women with your character. And it's, I mean, I think a lot of people who are from marginalized groups now, it's like, oh, you can't write an unlikable character that's of a certain group because, you know, you're, and all of that is so unfair. You want to write.
They have,
you
to know, be attractive and gasp, plucky.
Yeah, plucky.
You know, stuff like that.
Completely, you never sweat, and you never, yeah, and you never have petty thoughts or feelings. And all my characters are incredibly petty and unlikable. I guess unlikable, but they're. I just wanted to write people that were human. And I remember doing a talk once a long time ago, and some older man told me that I was misogynist, and I'm like, what? I'm a woman. I'm writing what? No, I'm not. She doesn't represent all women. I'm writing a character with certain flaws that propel a plot. just like men do. And
have you guys read Ivy Pacoda's new book, Sing Her Down?
No, I really.
It's
I've
all
read,
about that theme.
I really want to.
You know,
I
it's all about violence, and you know, men are allowed by society to express their violent impulses. You know, but women aren't. And
I,
she really
I love
gets
the whole
into
concept
that.
Of that book.
It's
and
really
read,
good.
I've read excerpts from it. Ivy Pacoda is such a great writer.
It's a real
and it's like
gutsy
a modern
book.
Day Western, like that. You know. Yeah. Women just out of prison, and I can't wait to read that
Not
book.
To talk about another yeah. writer's books.
No,
but,
no, we love it. We love it.
You know, Patrick did her virtual launch, actually, so you can watch it on our Facebook or YouTube. Really yeah. great conversation.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Anything else from you, or should we ask the audience?
Let's ask the audience. That'd be All great. Right. You guys are here too, right?
There any place you won't go?
Good question.
I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is that there are places that I feel like we're not supposed to go. We were touching before on sort of the own voices, a sort of pressure that's out there to not ever write a character that you have not sort of like walked in their shoes. And that, I think that is confining sometimes. And also I always go darker than, I always get edited back from, I always write what I want to write. And then I get sort of pulled back to try to be, more sort of palatable to a wider audience because, you know, not everybody has the same capacity and desire to really go into darkness. And I don't really write violence, but it's more just emotional darkness. But actually, interestingly, on the own voices thing, I did write for Audible. I was able to write a book with a neurodivergent teenage girl who's the narrator. And we were able to do that because they hired a performer who is autistic. And they actually trained her to perform the audiobook. She's an advocate and a social media influencer for autism. And she guided that book, and we made some changes to her mannerisms and things to be, you know, more to be more authentic and to relate to a wider range of people with neurodivergent, who are neurodivergent. And so that was the only book that I've ever been able to sort of write in a sort of a group that does that I haven't experienced personally myself.
Well, I think in terms of like what, where won't you go? In terms of just, I mean, I've written about people whose children have been killed. Like that's probably like the darkest thing I can imagine. I don't think I'd ever kill a dog in my books.
You're not allowed to. That's a good. No, that's against the rule.
I just don't want to write about it. But I'll tell you though. I mean, like even in terms of writing about that somebody whose child has been murdered, I to me it's the way you approach it. Like to me, it's like if I'm writing about that, I am going to look at the grief and the loss, and the memories, and I'm not going to describe a play-by-play of what happens to this child because I don't. Think that adds to what I'm trying to say with the book. So I think it's more, but I still wouldn't kill a dog ever, but I think it's sort of just the way you, it's not like I wouldn't go there to the subject matter, but I wouldn't approach it in a way of where it's very graphic or overly, you know, described. Some kids do just that's true you know, but you don't need to describe it so much, you know, you just don't describe it that much. But no dogs, okay. Maybe a cat. I don't know, I'm kidding. I love cats, I'm kidding.
have you seen the sign up in the front of our store, which I absolutely love? I found it somewhere and sort of expresses it. Said, you know, unattended children will be given espresso and a new puppy. But I've always thought that really was, you know, great way to look at all of that. Does anybody else have a question? Merle.
You sort of answered it because the question was originally, had you know that part, but the other part is, were you competing with anyone else? Like, were there other people also?
I assume so, but I don't know. You know, all I knew is that it came through my agent, write 20 pages, and then I waited a little while, and then I heard that I got the job, and I was thrilled. But I don't know. I have no idea.
It can go either way. I mean, sometimes, you know, the publisher already has another person in mind, or the estate. It's actually, the estate is sort of the commissioning thing, the two Parker children. And it goes through Putnam as a publishing company, and there's an editor there. But, no, you know, the kids have a voice in the whole thing, so it's more complicated. And maybe sometimes they have a person in mind, and then other times they might try out several. I don't think it's necessarily the same process every time. I mean, we've been watching the whole Clancy evolution here, and last night we saw it again. And Vince Flynn, you know, transferring over to somebody else, and now the Parker. And you know, Brett Battles has written a Stuart Woods, for example. I mean, this is an ongoing thing where people come in. And sometimes people who take on somebody else's universe, after a while, feel they've done all they can with it and decide they want to go back to their own writing, which is why Ace after 10 books, or Kyle Mills after, can't remember how many, Vince Flynn's. Mark Cameron, who's been writing Tom Clancy Sr., or sorry, Jack Ryan Sr., have all decided to, you know, hand it off to somebody else, which then sometimes they get to pick out who it is. Kyle actually picked the guy that he wants to write Vince Flynn. So there isn't any template for it, you know. I think it's an interesting part of publishing, but I mean, part of it, let's face it, is just to make money, because publishers are in business. But a lot of it is really for fans who are, you know, desolate to lose a character, as I said earlier. So there we are, you know. Uh-huh. Yep. Well, could you hand me the three books underneath my phone? Oh. Thank you. I always like to give things away to thank you all for coming. So, is there somebody here who came for Wendy who's never read Parker? You're a relative. I'm not sure I could count. Are you a person? All right, then I'm going to give you my advanced reading copy of Allison's book. This is what I get, guys. This is how, because I got it months ago.
Yeah.
All right. And conversely, did anybody come for Allison who has not read Wendy? Who has not read Wendy?
My book.
Did you come to hear Allison, but in fact you now heard Wendy? All right, then I'm passing this one back to you.
I love it. It's such a good book.
That's right. You're welcome. And now I have a book that I really loved, and I somehow got an extra copy. This is hilarious. There is a movement now towards, we had this whole discussion about aging, right? Permanently 39. But there is a whole elder sleuth thing going on. And this book was actually written by a former CIA employee. It's a 55-year-old woman who has been forcibly retired, because that is the retirement age. She's a sniper, and she is incredibly physically and whatever. And I love this book. I think, to be really honest, I think it sort of falls apart at the end. I think she had so much going on it that she wasn't quite sure how to bring it down. But the voice is fabulous. The character is great. And it's starting a series. And her name is Helen Warrick. And you're going to see more books where older women and sometimes men are empowered to do things. You know, if 60 is the new 40 or 80 is the new 60, you know, then I think we'll it certainly is for me, right? When I get to be 90, I'm not that far off. We'll see how that works. But anyway, I'm going to give this to the woman from Ohio. You've come the farthest. So I really love this book. It's called, sorry, if you couldn't see, Second Shot by Cindy Deese, and I really recommend it. But I also recommend the fact you look for some of these. We have a Second Shot, and the author's name is Cindy with a C and then Deese, D-E-E-S, and the publisher is Kensington, and it's just come out. And in July, on the 29th, Spencer Quinn, whom some of you may have read his Bernie and Chet mysteries where the dog is the narrator and all. That dog is never going to die. Anyway, he has written a book called Mrs. Plansky's Revenge. And Mrs. Plansky is a 70-year-old Floridian widow who Romanian group has scammed out of all her money. And she sets forth to Romania to reclaim it. And Deanna Rayburn wrote a book called, do you remember the title? What is it? Killers of a Certain Age, which involves several former spies, all of them in their 70s, I think, who go after. So you're going to see more of that. And I love that because basically we're talking about it's not all women, but a lot of them are women. I love the fact that women are being empowered, you know, at an older age. Yes. So I think that the older sleuth thing is going to be, it used to be, it was only a cozy, you know, it was sort of mm-hmm. cute, but now it's really kick ass. And I love that. So anyway, thank you all very much for coming tonight. Let's give our authors a round of applause. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.